and welcome to the All Japan Women's Destiny podcast. I'm your host, JD. Welcome to another episode as we go through the history of All Japan Women's Professional Wrestling through the classics episodes that you can find on various places of the internet. I vastly encourage to follow along and learn and enjoy the history of this just awesome women's wrestling promotion of the past. This is a spin-off in conjunction with the Red Leaf Retrocast. That is the proper episode where these come from. It is myself and Kay running through the history of All Japan Women. And these episodes, we hope you enjoy our audio and our discussions over the various wrestlers and the matches in which you go through the ages. If you like what you hear and you want more content, please consider checking out the Patreon. That is patreon.com/redleafretrocast, all one word, where we also cover LLPW, Kay covers JD Star, various other women's wrestling promotions of the past, and the project that the whole reason it exists is the Joshi 2010s journey, where we go through coming out of the dark ages of Joshi professional wrestling and really learning and having fun with wrestlers that we're very familiar with to this day, to ones that we may have missed out on. I hope you enjoy the audio you're about to hear covering AJW. And if you want more, please, again, consider signing up to the Patreon and leaving us reviews over at iTunes, Spotify, and the like, all your favorite podcasting outlets in which you listen to AJW and the Red Leaf Retrocast. Enjoy. It's time to talk that All Japan Women.
Oh yeah, the best part of the retro. My personal opinion, of course.
Yeah, especially for me, considering I'm watching most of this for the first time. Until we get to like the biggest and most famous matches. Most of these I've never seen before. And knowing how much research we just continue to do, that when history starts unfolding before our eyes, we just immediately notice it. Ah, this is the time. Really cool. This episode's a good example of that.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is the first time I've seen a lot of this. I don't think I've ever watched, what we're about to cover today, the Japanese Grand Prix, at least the 91 one, I haven't. So we have All Japan Women's Classics, episode 48, courtesy of Purisu Dream and Samurai TV.
Yeah, we're kind of like all at the halfway matches. Point, in a way.
Oh, yeah. We're at 51. I think there's like a 200 episodes or something like that.
Is there really 200? I thought there was like 120.
No, I think it's got 198. I could be completely Ooh. Off, but I think there's got 198 all right. or something.
Scratch that halfway point.
It goes into the 2000s. It goes all the way into the 2000s. So, but episode 48, all of these matches are from Cork and Hall on August 18th, 1991. We start with the All Japan Women Singles Championship, their future belt. Kako Inoue versus Mariko Yoshida. I'm not gonna lie.
Shoulder pads are back.
This match. Yeah. I'm not gonna lie. Shoulder pads. This is probably the best I've seen her. Kind of. Maybe. In a singles match, at least.
I don't know. Mariko Yoshida definitely has a ways to go. Her whole gimmick is these shoulder pads, and now she's bedazzled them.
Yeah, she's like, they're like doilies. That's what I call them. Like doilies on her shoulder, because they have all those like, kind of like patterns on them. Super weird. Takako looks good, of course, because Takako is good.
She's improving, and she's kind of in this, she's in this weird stage of getting a push, but because the top of the card is kind of set, and so is the white belt situation, and the tag titles are, well, overrun with Jungle Jack.
Of course they are. This is kind of the hottest team right now, so yeah.
So this is a good spot for her. There's a lot of names that we haven't seen in a while on these classics, like Kaoru comes to mind, the Honey Wings.
Yeah, we have it. We have it also seen, though I'm not complaining, Yumika Hota. I haven't seen a whole lot of her either. We've seen, what, last episode, I think, was the first that we saw her in a while?
Yeah, Hota's a strange case. They more or less try to keep her, I guess, a little bit strong and just kind of slot her in just every once in a while. She's definitely not in any kind of big programs or not, because otherwise, like, what we try to do is find matches in between the classics, or that's what we've been doing on All Japan Women Destiny, just kind of filling in those gaps. And these classics are more and more frequent in time now. I guess the tape trading of the era was much better documented, and the wrestling was at an all-time high, and it's only getting better for All Japan Women at this point in time.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird thing that you mentioned, like, the tape trading was probably better at that point. I think it's because VHS had become so widely adopted around the 90s, beginning of the 90s, right? Most people were able to finally have access to them.
Yeah.
Japan. Yeah. Over here in the States, it was still, like, a pricey item, if memory serves.
VHS, Betamax. I mean, I had tons of VHS tapes growing up around this, around in 91.
I was born in 91, so most of my... I mean, I had a whole ton of VHSs when I was, like, a child. I think everything I had was on VHS. It was DVD players when those came out that were super expensive and a big deal when your family brought them home.
Yeah, I gotta try to remember when these technologies finally came into my household. But I was always, like, kind of behind the times as a kid with technology. Yeah, but yeah, Takako Inoue, in a way, I really like what I'm seeing from her. I'm more familiar with Takako Inoue's, like, 1993 form. So her in this phase of I'm gonna try to be Norio Tateno is really funny to me, and Cutie Suzuki, kind of mixing the two together.
Yeah. I'm more familiar with her late 90s, like 97, 8, and 9, where she's like biker bad bitch. That's what I'm more familiar with Takako. So seeing her like this is super weird. Even though I knew this form of her existed, I've never actually watched it, so watching it's kind of odd. It definitely doesn't fit her. You can tell it doesn't fit her because she's very, like, I don't know. What's the word for it? Like, she's like, she's trying to put on an act. You can tell she's not really comfortable doing.
I don't agree with that. It just looks like she's trying to figure out who she is.
She's going through her teenage angst phase. Anyways, next match.
My favorite match on this entire classics.
Oh, that's I like this match too a little bit. Mostly for the Akira Hokuto stuff. It is Etsuka Mita and Suzuka Manami versus Bull Nakano, Professor Bull Nakano, and Akira Hokuto, Almost Dangerous Queen.
Yeah, she dyed
her hair.
Yeah, she cut her hair a little bit. She's got gel. It's blonde now, or it's kind of more of a white blonde.
Yeah, her entrance attire is more akin to that of the Dangerous Queen, with the more, like, regal, Japanese regal sort of style to it.
Yeah, she's
more
got that,
like,
wild
flash into it.
Yeah, she's got the coat. This is a big turning point in her character, for sure.
Yeah, the only thing she's missing is when she takes that coat off, she's still wearing the same shitty old bathing suit, or lifeguard gear.
She's still got that going on, yeah, but her in-ring style has just taken a massive turn. She's much more stiff, very hard slapping. She's not
very
aggressive. She's not jumping from the top over and over again anymore. It's a complete style and character change to really just tack on her fantastic 1991, easily her best year in her career to date.
As far as we've watched, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I can't wait till we get to the mask, but she finally puts the damn mask on. It goes full Dangerous Queen, comes out with the katana and everything. Oh, it's just great. But we're getting there. Ever so slowly, we're getting there.
Yeah. Mita's job in this match was to get the shit kicked out of her by Nakano and Hokuto.
Oh, yeah, she was, like, mostly in the ring getting her ass kicked. I don't think she got any offense in, or at least none that I could
recall. Very little.
Getting her ass kicked so much. Speaking of transformations, Bull Nakano getting a little bit bigger again.
Yeah,
I think
another...
we saw for a bit there she had lost some of that weight, and now she's gaining a lot of it back rapidly, too, which is not exactly a good sign.
Yeah, another form change for Nakano, this time in her weight. Her legs look like they've grown twice the size yet again. She's notably slowed down in the ring. And
yeah,
she was out of this match for a good chunk of time.
Yeah, I think if memory serves, this is around the time she was having really bad back issues. Like all those leg drops and doing the Harlem Hangover, and so I think she was having a lot of bad back issues, constantly landing on her leg like that. Like her legs were bothering her, her knees and her back.
Yeah, she's not taped up or anything though, which is interesting.
No, I think that's on purpose though. I think she's the big bad monster.
Right.
I think that's by design. She doesn't want to, because that looks weak, right? You can't look weak when you're the big bad champion monster.
I suppose you're right.
You kind of hide that by not being in the ring as often when you're in a tag match.
So,
I'm curious when she wins your next singles match if we start seeing more of that.
Yeah. So this is a further build of the Nakano Hokuto tag team that's now formed during this era, right before the tag league starts, and these two are going to be in it together.
Yeah, it's a very interesting team up too, especially because I don't believe Hokuto ever joins Goku Minto. I know we obviously Kyukyo Inoue joins, but I don't believe Hokuto ever fully joins. I think she just teams with her. Could be mistaken. I have my timeline off a little bit on.
Well, clearly Bull Nakano was a bad influence on Hokuto, really changing her into this this delinquent looking person.
Or is she a good influence? Because we're getting closer to the monster dangerous queen where she just murders bitches.
It's pretty wild. No matter, we consistently reiterate how just a small period of time that form of Hokuto is, and it's what she's most well known for.
Yeah, it's only the span of like, maybe 5 years tops, maybe.
Well, her as a fully active wrestler, it's more like what, a year and a half, 2 years, and then she's like part time.
So if you add up the dates that she would have, like, she wouldn't even be wrestling a full year technically.
Yeah, that's what's wild to me. The more and more we go into this. I really love this match. It was just a lot of hard hitting. Really got over a lot of the new characters. Plays into that story between Suzuka Minami and Hokuto more. And Hokuto does not win this match with the Northern Lights Bomb. It's not even that. She wins it with, what was that move?
It was like some kind of like arm move thing that she did, right? Where it was kind of like a hold move.
Don't remember.
I'm trying to remember now, too, because I know it wasn't the Northern Lights Bomb. It kind of came out of nowhere a little bit, too.
Yeah, let me just pull that little video up. It was... Yeah, Suzuka Minami gives her a big, dirty look at the end of the match.
Yeah, the big, nasty, like, oh, you bitch, kind of look.
It was a double-arm DDT. That's what it was.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, not her finisher, not what she would be known for.
Yeah, it's a big jumping double arm DDT, kind of like Shinya Hashimoto in a weird little way. That's that really struck me as surprising. I love this match.
John Moxley.
Yes, it's kind of like a Death Rider, except she goes up instead of her opponent.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's really cool. This is definitely a match to go out and seek out.
Yeah, it was definitely good. Also, Suzuka Minami doing her best. I want to be Minami Toyota, the better Minami.
Yeah, she's got matching gear, impression. The long black hair, got a little makeup on. Definitely a lot of fashion choices are changing within AJW. This is a lot of fun. This is a fun time. And also
to see a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah, also going on this time is our completion of the Grand Prix in 91. We saw kind of a little bit of the first round. We saw Inoue and Yamada go to I think it was a 30-minute draw. Could have been a 20. And,
I think it was a 20.
And so they have to rematch here on the final day at Cork and Hall for a quarterfinal match. So whoever goes on, if they're going to win this thing, they have to win 3 straight matches on the same night. I got to say, Kay, this Grand Prix was booked phenomenally.
Yeah, it's one of the better ones, if memory serves. I think of the ones that I've seen so far, I think this has been the one that's got the better booking all throughout.
Yeah, I thought it was very genius. Who went over and how, building new stars, getting them to the top of the card, how it played into kind of the 1990 Grand Prix in a weird way. But as for the matches themselves, so there's 4 here we watched in their entirety, with the last one only being like 12 minutes. It wasn't very long at all. Although when you potentially have 3 matches in the same night, it's probably better that you go 12. But I'm comparing
Kyoko and Yamada over there, Yamada obviously loses that one, right? Yeah.
Yamada lost to Inoue, but before, like, just to reiterate my point, when I was thinking back on the other Grand Prix from AJW, I can't think of a standout match in this tournament as kind of a top-end match. I think, like I said, I think this is the best booked one with what they were doing. So the story's told is the most interesting. But from a in-ring standpoint, I think every other one previous to this was just better.
Yeah, so it's kind of, to draw like a modern-day comparison with the modern-day AGW, as I call them, Stardom. I had the same feeling always with the five-star. Like, I always feel like there's good matches, but they never leave a lasting impression. I think that's kind of the nature of the tournament, right?
I guess that's how I've
always seen the things, right?
Well, maybe with the format change of longer matches, we can start getting more memorable moments and matches. But you know what? The New Japan in the G1 kind of suffers from that as well, where there's so many good matches that they all kind of blend together.
There's just so many matches, period, especially in the G1's case, that nothing stands out because there's so much you're watching. You watch one thing and then you forget about it because you're watching the next thing.
Well, that's why you got to write it down in like a book or something or a spreadsheet and make a little note next to it to remind you.
Pull the U, have a big old Excel document.
That's right. I'm an Excel guy. I'm not a notebook guy. Although it would be fun to just get a nice, nice spiral notebook or something and write all these things down over time. That'd be cool to have for the test of time over the years.
A physical copy of things. Yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
It'd be a neat little thing. Speaking of which, I just got the List of Jericho, that book.
Yeah?
It's kind of put together the same way the Ice Ribbon book is, where it's a lot of stats and just fun little quips every now and again.
Yeah. Speaking of the Ice Ribbon book, I still need to go through most of it. It's an interesting read. I had to refresh myself because I don't think I didn't finish it the last time I had it, and I couldn't find my copy, so I had to buy another one, obviously. Some very cool stuff and very interesting stuff. A gaijin going over there was able to sort of get unsurface in a way. It was kind of interesting. I wonder if he spoke Japanese. I don't think he ever says in the book, not to my knowledge.
I would think he would.
It would have to be, right, to be able to get all that information. There'd be no way, right?
Yeah. All right, so Grand Prix time. Quarterfinal, Inoue, Yamada.
So Inoue obviously beats Yamada. I don't think this was better than the 30-minute draw. I thought the 30-minute draw had a lot more going on in it.
Yes, I agree. I think that was the better match.
Yeah. But then we move to the next one. Tag team partners, Aja Kong versus Bison Kimura. Jungle Jack explodes. This one, I was actually surprised at the result. I did not expect Bison Kimura to win.
Yeah, this is really
Kong,
cool.
But she dismantled Aja Kong, kept focusing on her leg and her knee and just slowly wearing down the leg and the power of Aja Kong. It was a very smart strategy when you look at it. Sort of get rid of her base so that she can't do moves. There was that spot where Kong goes for the spinning back fist, but because she can't plant on both legs to spin fully, it ends up not even really hitting all that hard. And so Bison's able to sort of counter back on it, and I thought that was a very, very cool spot.
Bison's got a nice slick hairdo going on, little bit of a perm. Still a very beautiful woman, and I do love her kind of zebra gear that she's sporting.
Her zebra gear, yeah. It's just kind of a themes with her gear. I think she's always had kind of gear that's got animal print on it in some way.
Well, it kind of goes with the whole Jungle Jack, Gokumon Toe kind of feel to it. You know, Bull, Kong, Bison.
Yeah, they all got interesting gear choices. Well, fucking Aja's had the same gear for like ever. In modern day, she wears the same gear. Just, it's kind of interesting how consistent she's been with that.
Well, except when one Erica hangs out in Hustle, she doesn't wear the same thing.
That's a different person, I'll have you know. And Hustle is a fantastic promotion that I never thought I'd like. So you shut your mouth, bad-mouthing the Hustle.
Oh, no.
It has the best wrestler, Hard Gay, and Real Gay, his rival.
If you want to listen to some Hustle reviews, head on over to the Patreon. You can thank Kay for those, for winning the monthly pick'em.
Yeah, another one's about to come up soon. Be prepared for that one. I can't wait. I've already got a few shows in mind.
Oh no!
but as for
the Kong Kimura match, it's one of those where it's not going to blow you away, but the story of the match is where it's interesting. I wish it was a much more exciting match for sure, because it goes on forever. It's a dismantling of Kong, as you said. Bison Kimura's new thing these days is coming out with a fucking like police baton, a nightstick.
Yeah, the nightstick.
Yeah, and she's just battering Kong's ankle and leg. She's biting it. She's trying to break every rule she possibly could, because that's what's going to take Kong out. And Kong did a phenomenal job just selling it and always staying on the ground screaming. Who knew Aja Kong was such a good seller?
Yeah, I mean, nowadays she can't obviously sell like that.
No, no.
But like I said, there was that cool spot where she goes for the back fist, but because she can't plant on both legs, like, ends up hitting Kimura, but, like, not even really phasing Kimura because she couldn't get all the force behind it. So right. Kimura's able to, like, get her back on it.
Yeah, completely powers through it in a way, and Kong kind of stumbles out of it. It's a very interesting match that won't blow you away excitement-wise, but the story plays an excellent part to building Bison Kimura as this kind of technical destroyer, I guess, and a fun decision that pays off dividends. And this kind of goes into what we've seen is this kind of slotting of Bison Kimura as not quite main eventer. And with a win like this, it does put her in that contention. You still don't think that she's red belt material, but certainly white belt material.
Right. You noticed you mentioned the length of the match. I actually like the length of the match because it showed that it takes a long time to break down someone as formidable as Aja Kong. I think the length of the match played into the overall sort of theme of the match. It takes a long time to break down the monster, right? Keeps Aja looking strong because it took so long for that process to work.
Yeah,
I thought that was smart.
Probably the best match in the tournament. Probably. Yeah.
Well, I think the one we're about to talk to next is probably my favorite, but that's got my bias in it. But that is Kyoko Inoue versus my wife, Manami Toyota.
Yeah, semifinal. Yep.
Yeah, I liked this match. I thought Manami was clearly the better wrestler between the two in this one, and I think that showed, like, almost right off the bat. I can't tell if it's because Inoue was gassed. It probably had something to do with it, but Manami Toyota is just on fire. The crowd loves it. Every time she gets the top rope, you can hear the crowd just come alive because they know some wild shit's about to happen.
Yeah, Manami Toyota certainly has
it. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, she has a certain crowd connection with her just explosion and speed and excitement to just what she's able to do. I'm going to save one Kyoko Inoue conversation for the finals because, spoiler, she beats Manami Toyota. Okay, what did you think of this decision?
I got why they were doing it, because obviously Manami won the year prior, so even though I think she was supposed to win it, obviously, I thought that was supposed to be Hokuto. I think we both went over that, right? It was supposed to be Hokuto, but she got hurt.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously you're not going to have her repeat, or even repeat the finals, for that matter, and this is all about Kyoko Inoue getting her big push. I can't fault the decision because of what they're going for. Personally, I would have called an audible because I'm like, Manami Toyota is way more over than Kyoko Inoue. You could just tell by the crowd's reaction to both of them in the match. Kyoko does something and she gets a reaction, but Manami just goes to the top rope. The crowd just fucking comes alive every time.
She's a drop.
Like,
oh my god,
what is she gonna do?
She's a dropkick machine.
That too, right? The crowd loves her. She's so ahead of her time at this point, right? She's just doing the most nuts crap off the top rope, doing way before Jeff Hardy was doing nuts shit off the top rope, right? It's kind of
definitely no
nuts.
Regard for her own body. So here was something I was thinking about. Why wouldn't obviously they turned an audible with the Akira Hokuto story in 91. They had their playbook with her. But why wouldn't you try to go to her for 91? Since this is a massive year for Hokuto. She's clearly doing a lot of strides in her singles career and now teaming with Bull Nakano. Why wouldn't she go far in this tournament?
I think you just mentioned it. She's in a program with the top champion, so she really doesn't need to win the Grand Prix.
Yeah, I understand.
Grand Prix
but if you want to make it,
star,
yeah.
Hokuto is already being established, so you kind of need to do that with Kyoko Inoue to kind of make her seem like a formidable threat.
Yeah, that was my thought exactly. I just thought it was interesting considering the previous year she was pretty much the one that was going to win and get a big push, but they had their plan for 91 and they're sticking to it. You have to admire the ability to put many people over in different ways to slot them. You can definitely see Stardom's booking style is kind of out of this playbook, And this is a good example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm about to mention that with the finals, too, because I don't know if you want to reveal this, but we're recording this separately from the main stuff where I'll definitely be discussing my thoughts on the five-star predictions. And the way this is formatted strikes eerily similar to how Stardom formats their finals.
Yeah.
Yes, without further ado, the finals, Bison, Kimura, and Kyoko Inoue. So, I guess before I talk about the match, I want to sort of mention what I was talking about with how they structure things.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel like the five-star, and by extension, I guess, the Grand Prix, always has the similar formula. You have the person who's almost a shoe-in to win, or is a favorite to win, and the other person who's somebody who's right around the top of the card. Maybe they're like upper mid-card, or they're upper on the card, but it's just not their time yet. That's always the runner-up, right? Think about last year, Himeka, right? The year before that, it was Utami.
Yeah?
Konami. The year before that was Utami. Every time, it's kind of been a similar pattern. So I think that's a smart way to go about it, right? Because it keeps this person who's not just there yet looking strong by being the runner-up in the five-star, or in this case, the Grand Prix. And it also highlights the person you want to win. So both of them kind of get a bit of a rub there. So I think that was sort of the plan here with Bison, Kimura, and Kyoko Inoue. Obviously, this match, I don't think this match was as good.
It's one of the weaker ones of the entire tournament.
Yeah, because Kyoko Inoue was clearly gassed. Like, I think by the end of the Manami Toyota match, she could barely kind of stand. She was so tired.
It was a lot of selling from Kyoko Inoue. Bison Kimura was doing her technical dismantling, as she did with Aja. It's like, oh shit, I beat Kong with this style. Makes sense you'd want to do that with a more high flyer that Kyoko Inoue in 91 is.
Right.
Kay, her style, I am not seeing it. I am not feeling it. She's very erratic. She has her, like, two moves, and she just kind of rinse repeats this a lot of the time. I think that's why I like that 30-minute draw with Yamada better, because Yamada is such a... She's such a good striker
wrestler.
She's a dynamic
striker.
Yeah, and that's able to bring a different flow to a match, and it keeps Inoue kind of in check. When you have Kimura making her sell a lot, and that makes sense because she was tired. When you get a match like the Manami Toyota Inoue one, where it's just running the entire time, three completely different matches for Kyoko Inoue, and I got to agree with the booking decision through the tournament. If you're going to look, Kyoko Inoue has been in the main event, but she doesn't have these big staggering singles wins. She's got a couple kind of scattered here or there. You feel like she's on the precipice of getting it. And the way they built up Bison Kimura in this tournament and the journey of Kyoko Inoue getting to the finals and winning in this case, that's a big moment for her in her career. So, like, a booking wise, I got no issue with this. This is very interesting. They built a new star out of it. I'm not feeling the Inoue style at this point in time, but we'll see. I love the ambition and making new stars. We constantly talked about that in depth throughout 1990, and they've been off to the races in 91. They got a very strong top of the card. They have a strong tag division that they've built, and the white belt has consistent contenders and stories built around it. This is a full promotion at this point in time, and it's only getting better.
Yeah, it's funny because we were just talking about how after the Crush Gals, everything felt like it was in a state of disarray. Like, everything was not there. They had no one in place. They had a lot of people that were almost there, but just no one was even established before the... Like, kind of like how years prior, they would have these people established almost immediately right off the bat. Now we're starting to see it. I mean, people we're seeing right now, these are the stars that are going to define the rest of this company.
Well, what's crazy to think about, or interesting, I should say, is these people that we're seeing being built, the people of exception to this is Bull Nakano, Hokuto, and Hota. Everyone afterwards was so young that they weren't affected slot-wise by that previous generation, the Crush Gals and company. So they're all brand new to the audience. Turnover, you're building a new audience with these fresh faces. So you can slot them and build them up from scratch, which honestly, I think it really helped. And that's why the turnaround was so much faster, because sometimes it takes years and years to rebuild a promotion like this. But they had such great rookie classes, and all it took was a couple years of development, and then it's just off to the races as we're seeing now. And you don't have the Chigusa Nagayos, the Devil Masamis, the Dumps to continuously be on top. You just have all these open slots that you can put these people in. Just to make a kind of comparison to modern day Stardom in 2021, they kind of went through a similar phase with the number of retirements that they had at the top of the card, people leaving the promotion, like a B Priestley, as an example for the Gaijin. You know, we're seeing Debbie Malenko in the undercard being developed as a Gaijin that's on the come up. I find that comparison very valid. And TJPW is kind of the same way, not so much in the sense that they had people missing. It's just the top of the card is just so open and able to have these new fresh faces. That's what keeps the promotion fresh and interesting. Just some thought comparisons that I had worth discussing.
Yeah, no, I think you're right on the money with that. I think right now this promotion is obviously starting that they're building that card. Like I said, this is the card, or these are the people that are going to define the rest of this company's lifespan.
This is going to be the
people that define
falter,
the entirety of the 90s and some of the early 2000s before they close. Some of them will be around during that. But it's kind of weird because when you look at this, this is about to stop. This is the last time they actually make stars. So it's also kind of a double-edged sword for them.
Yeah, so that's going to be a topic worth discussing as we go through the years, because we'll get to the supercard era when LLPW and JWP and Gaia, JD Star, all these companies are around, and to see kind of how rookie classes come, who we see at the undercard is kind of pay attention to, and what decisions are made over time. That's going to be fun to discuss. Is the supercard kind of the last hurrah that they had? But, you know, another conversation worth having somewhere else is how the economy plays such a role in a lot of these decision-making moments for the company. Very interesting times. Episode 48, this Cork and Hall show, the Grand Prix, very well-booked tournament. It's one of the best booked tournaments I think I've ever seen from a pushed commodity perspective, despite there being no blowaway matches. It's very fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as it's the best booked tournament I've seen.
It's one of the best.
Okay, I still agree with that. It's one of the best. It's very interesting. Very interesting going forward. Obviously, that means Kyoko Inoue is going to be facing her fellow stable mate and leader of Gokuminto, Bull Nakano, in a red belt match.
Yeah.
I think we both know how that's going to turn out. So.
It's not going to, but it's going to bode just as well for Kyoko Inoue as it did for Manami Toyota the previous year.
Might have a better chance. I think the fact that Manami's wasn't planned is kind of why that turned out the way it did.
I think the end result's going to be the same. Kyoko Inoue is going to eat a fire thunder bomb, and we move on to the next step.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but Kyoko Inoue doesn't win the red belt until, later.
Not yet.
No, not yet.
Okay. Yeah, fun. I'm looking forward to... Yeah, and if you take a look at kind of how the classics are lined up in the future, you get kind of a big show once a month at least from this point forward for many years. As when, and I kind of mentioned this at the top, was in previous years, you would miss all summer, or you would go 4 months without the next classic episode. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely going to be fun watching this as it goes forward.